Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, a vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be. In the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more roar for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud wall cabin eyes were watching through the night. Many a man big chest was throbbing for the blessed warning light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the banshee's lonely crew, and a thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest homeland, comrades. It's June the 17th, 2012. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. I want to begin this week with a few remarks about the passing of an old friend and comrade of mine, Tony Hancock, from England. Tony was well known throughout the movement as owner of the Print Factory and the editor of the Historical Review Press of Uckfield, East Sussex, in England. He died on the afternoon of June the 11th, 2012. He was first admitted to the hospital about 3 weeks ago, having suffered from a stroke, and although several people who visited him there report that he seemed to be recovering well, apparently on Monday he had a relapse and he died about 4:15 in the afternoon Greenwich time. Tony's late father, Alan Hancock, was an old Moseleyite black shirt, like so many of the best British patriots of his generation. He founded the Print Factory, and Tony kept up the family business. For a good 30 years, Tony was the go-to guy anytime anyone wanted any kind of right-wing or racial or revisionist printing done in Europe, in any European language. The historical revisionist cause in Britain and elsewhere in the English-speaking world owes a lot to Tony's dedication as a publisher, as a graphic designer, and as an editor. Back in the pre-internet days, HRP was pretty much it, the only printer in Europe who would publish revisionist works. Britain's race laws are bad, but at least so far they've left book publishing alone, and therefore, until the internet came along, HRP published works from European authors which otherwise would never have seen the light of day. These included authors like Robert Farrison, Germar Rudolph, and of course Richard Harwood's famous Did 6 Million Really Die? It goes without saying that Tony was the almost daily recipient of death threats and every kind of harassment and intimidation imaginable, from the police, from the British government, from the Reds, and the so-called Antifas. Tony's print works in Uckfield, East Sussex, was burned down in 1980 by a Jewish arsonist named Manny Karpel, at the time a quote-unquote freelance Searchlight researcher, according to Searchlight editor Jerry Gable. Karpel was arrested and jailed for 2.5 years, which is a light sentence for arson. I suspect they took him in the front door of the prison and snuck him out the back. I myself first met Tony in 1982 in Brighton when I was on the run from the Greensboro grand jury, and I'd first arrived in the British Isles as more or less a fugitive. He was just a great guy, one of the personally best individuals, the brightest, the friendliest, the most knowledgeable, and the most loyal that I have ever met in this movement. I have since corresponded with him regularly, and since the advent of email, we talked at least once a month. By the way, I think he would appreciate my mentioning him on Radio Free Northwest, since he always promoted RFN to his own list. Not much to say, really, except that another giant has departed from among us. Tony was one of the stalwarts, and he will be deeply missed. Now for a few quick emails. This one is from Roy in Australia. And for some reason I'm not completely sure of, Radio Free Northwest is starting to get a lot of listeners and fans in Australia. Apparently the racial situation down under is getting really bad. Anyway, it goes, Hi, Harold. Not sure if you're aware that Cafe Press is using a black man as part of the ads for the Northwest Front gear they're selling on your behalf, I suppose. It is not a good look for a pro-white product to have such material associated with it. Personally, it puts me off. Just my 2 cents worth. Sincerely, Roy. Dear Roy, first off, those aren't actual niggers. Those are computer-generated holographic mannequins. Yes, I know about them, and no, I don't like it, and no, there's nothing we can do about it so long as we have to use Jewish outfits like Cafe Press to produce our T-shirts and toys and knickknacks. Now, if we could get our own people to step forward and fulfill the same function that these Jews fulfill, we could do something about it, but so far I can't. So we're going to have to put up with the computer-generated niggers and NVA T-shirts. Until such time as some of you are willing to step forward, pack your shit into the U-Haul, come here to the homeland, and help me, among other things, set up Northwest Publishing Agency and other front companies as proper businesses, centrally controlling the production of Northwest books, literature, bumper stickers, coffee mugs, T-shirts, business cards, CDs, DVDs, merchandise, and so forth, as well as producing the merchandise and filling the orders to raise money for the cause, which is the way it should be, but isn't because white nationalists are so useless. I'm sorry I'm rambling again, but anyway, until that day comes, we are going to have to rely on Jew outfits like Cafe Press to fulfill this very basic function of any political or social movement. As always, the answer to this problem lies in white people changing their thinking, changing their behavior, and changing their basic character, which is why it doesn't get done. Now, for that matter, I am in fact amazed that almost none of you have even bothered to set up your own Cafe Press sites to sell your own Northwest toys and knickknacks, which can be done on a home computer inside of an hour. Half a dozen NF graphics, which I don't begrudge and would be happy to supply, 1 hour's work on those computers that you love so much, and you'd actually have a genuine home business with an income stream. How much money you make would depend on what kind of effort you want to put into it, but of course, that's the rub. I mean, my God, if you guys would just show a little hustle, you could actually make money doing this. Marketing Northwest Front stuff. I don't care so long as it spreads the message of the 14 words in the Northwest Republic. Now, I rant and rave about how white Americans won't do anything unless they're paid, but even that's not right, apparently. Most of us don't even seem to want to make money if it actually requires any effort on our part beyond dragging our asses into some shit job and clocking in and doing some zombie-like repetitive task for 8 hours to make money for some Jew somewhere until you yourself can clock out again and go home to the beer in the fridge. That's the way most white boys live. It's the way we've been conditioned to live. Every spark of initiative seems to have been drained out of us by the beer and the high fructose corn syrup. The idea of actually exerting yourself to create and market and build a business, something which our race has always been top-notch at doing, has been beaten out of this present generation of white kids. I guess we're all too busy just staring into the computer monitors and the television screens like zombies, letting ourselves drift while the Jews tell us what to think and what to do and how to live our lives. Now, it's not just the pioneer spirit that seems to be dead. Any white entrepreneurial spirit of the kind that this country has always had seems to have vanished from among us. Seriously, people, there are a dozen ways that you could, in fact, be making money off the Northwest Independence Movement, if that's what you want, and doing so with my full approval because it advances the cause of the Northwest Republic in the 14 words, but I can't even get you to do that. Oh, there's been a little of it, including one enterprising kid in Alaska who actually brought out a pirate edition of The Brigade on Lulu.com, and he has the royalties from those sales sent to himself. But it's pretty bizarre that apparently I can't even really tempt you guys with money if you actually have to earn it. Weird. Okay, back to the emails. This one is from Elliot in Nevada, and it deals with a topic I've discussed before on several occasions. Dear Harold, you sounded really pissed off last week, but how do you expect people to respond to you when you're always making your audience feel bad about ourselves? You can catch more flies with honey than with vinegar. Signed, Elliot. Yeah, maybe so, but I'm not trying to catch flies. I'm trying to change the world, which is something I can't do without your active and committed physical and financial help. Now, you used a key word there, Elliot, audience. I do not have an organization. I don't have a movement. I don't even have a cult. I have an audience. And audiences don't change the world except sometimes in certain very limited circumstances when you can get an admission fee off them to pay for something off stage and in the real world, which so far I'm not managing too well at. As for making you feel bad about yourselves, the whole world that once was ours is about to come crashing down, and the misery that the departure of the white race will cause for all of humanity is beyond calculation. The extinction of the white man will be a catastrophe for this planet, and for whatever humanoid life remains on it. The gooks and niggers and mestizos will scrabble around for a few centuries trying to maintain and then trying to recover some of what the white man built, but none of them have the chops for it, and the human world will just sort of settle down into a kind of primal ooze from which nothing will ever emerge again. Now that's on you, because you're too timid and frightened and lazy and torpid to do what has to be done. You damned well should feel bad about yourselves. Look, if I had money, I'd use sweet words and pay you, bribe you to do the right thing. I don't have any money, so all I can do is rant and rave and shout at you and try to shame you into doing the right thing, which isn't working so well because no one seems to have much sense of shame left. Our ancestors were capable of being motivated into great deeds for fear of shame and how they would be viewed by history and their descendants. No one today seems to give a damn. Anyway, Elliot, basically that's it. I'm all stick because I've got no carrot. Okay, Gretchen is up next, and I owe her an apology from last week because she sent me these two reviews at the same time, and I got them out of order. This is the review she did on Pat Buchanan's book, which I should have broadcast last week, in which she refers to the fact that she's reading Alex Kurtajic's novel Mister, which she's going to review next, but unfortunately I already podcast that one last week, so if this sounds odd this week, that's why. This one was done first. It's my bad. I should have run this piece last week and saved Mister for this week. Sorry, Gretchen.
Comrades, tonight I'm going to be talking about Pat Buchanan's recent book, The Suicide of a Superpower. Every once in a while, Pat Buchanan writes one of these books, and basically, I'm sure they're all rather similar, a list of complaints, and then at the end, some proposals, and this book does have some very nice proposals in it, having to do with tariffs, protection of the border, and then also changing the immigration laws back to what they were before 1965. That was a very critical change in immigration law in 1965 because that's what really changed the balance here in the States. You know, this is the type of book, especially for the curmudgeons out there, sort of the Tea Party wannabes and people that need to use joint formula. And, you know, it's really quite funny because there actually is a joint formula called Joint Formula 88. So I guess that's the joint formula we'll be all using once we're in the nursing home. I have to say I enjoyed reading it, although I became rather distracted in the middle of reading it because recently I got hold of Mister, which is a book that I've wanted to get for a very long time, and in some respects the books do overlap. So I'm pretty excited about discussing Mister. I have to say that after I started reading Mister, which is a real page-turner, I got a little maybe bored with the Buchanan book, but still, the proposals are very solid. If someone wanted to actually enforce them, and I don't know how likely that is, but, you know, I'm sure there are those among us that can remember the time when Pat Buchanan was running for president and he won the New Hampshire primary, and back in the 90s, And come to think of it, that was a time when I was actually considering moving out to Idaho, and it's rather interesting. When I look back, it's almost like I was considering both at almost the same time, and I wonder if that's a contradiction in some ways. At any rate, I'm sure there's people out there that would enjoy, you know, reading this book. I mean, it's mainstream enough, you could pick it up at a library even. I hope you enjoyed this little review. Of course, the next one is going to be Mister that I talk about, and that's going to be very exciting. Now, another group that would really like this book, certainly Pat Buchanan is very Catholic, so that's another group. He does talk a great deal about social mores, family values, but at the end of the book, his suggestions really have more to do with sort of reshifting the ethnic balance in the States, and I think that's really more the problem than anything else. So I think he's right in concentrating on that point most specifically. And he does talk about the possible alienation of citizens when they live in a multi-ethnic kind of a situation or a multi-ethnic stew, because oftentimes citizens will feel like they feel alienated from other people and tend to withdraw. And there have been psychological studies on this that he cites. And I think that's a really good point. And it's also a point that comes up in Mister. So definitely, if you're more of a conservative, if you're interested in U.S. politics and history, constitution, and so forth, then this is definitely a book that I would recommend.
Last week's Rhodesian music selection got a pretty good response, and so that kind of put me in a bit of an African mood, white African that is, so I dug up a copy of that old mercenary favorite, Roland the Headless Thompson Gunner. This is Warren Zevon.
Roland was a warrior from the land of the midnight sun, with a Thompson gun for hire, fighting to be done. The deal was made in Denmark on a dark and stormy day, so he set out for Biafra to join the bloody fray. Through 66 and 7 they fought the Congo War with their fingers on their triggers, knee-deep in gore. Days and nights they battled the Bantu to their knees. They killed to earn their living and to help out the Congolese. Roland the Thompson Gunner, Roland the Thompson Gunner. Comrades fought beside him, Van Owen and the rest, but of all the Thompson gunners, Roland was the best. So the CIA decided they wanted Roland dead. That son of a bitch Van Owen blew off Roland's head. Roland the Headless Thompson Gunner, they can still see his headless body stalking through the night in the muzzle flash of Roland's Thompson gun. In the muzzle flash of Roland's Thompson gun. Roland searched the continent for the man who done him in. He found him in Mombasa in a ballroom drinking gin. Roland aimed his Thompson gun, he didn't say a word, but he blew out one's body Johannesburg.
Roll and the headless Thompson gunner. Roll and the headless Thompson gunner. Roll and the headless Thompson gunner.
Talking about the man.
Roll and the headless Thompson gunner.
Thompson gunner, still wandering through the night. Now it's 10 years later, but he still keeps up the fight. In Ireland, in Lebanon, in Palestine, in Berkeley, Paddy Hearst heard the burst of a Roland's Thompson gun and bought
guys, this is Axis Sally. Today I'd like to discuss affirmative action practices and people who play the race card whenever they don't get what they want out of life. Recently, a New York City judge ordered the city to pay $128 million to firefighters who allege the city used an entrance exam that deliberately sought to keep blacks and mestizos off the force. The department was also ordered to hire 293 so-called minorities. The lawsuit alleges that the entrance exam had little to do with firefighting and instead focused on reading and cognitive skills. What's funny is, this is a mainstream liberal news source and they inadvertently admitted that non-whites just plain can't read. Did you ever think that maybe, in a situation where your home and your family's lives are in danger, it might be good if those who were paid to save the day knew how to read? It's not just about throwing some water on a burning building and chopping down doors. If all you had to do on the job was basically throw stuff, break stuff, and carry stuff, then I agree it would be a great occupation for blacks if they didn't have to get out of bed too early. But since you do have to know how to read and how to think and how to act quickly, maybe the department needs an entrance exam that screens for these abilities. So who gets the $128 million? Lawyers for the firefighters who sued said some of this money would go to blacks and mestizos who failed the exam and were never hired. Sounds like a pretty good deal. Fail a test because you're not smart enough, then sue the city for being racist. Or even if you do get hired, you can still find a reason to sue for discrimination. And now, the city needs to hire 293 more illiterate non-whites who scored low on cognition tests. This is what happens when companies are ordered to diversify the workforce, or when universities need to meet affirmative action quotas. We end up with people who have jobs for which they're not qualified or trained, and students in classrooms that now have to be dumbed down for everyone else. And we also end up with schools and workplaces that are more dangerous because of the unrestrained animals who are now our classmates and co-workers. For decades, blacks have claimed that the SATs and IQ tests were biased against them because they didn't score well. I suppose they're right. The tests are biased against those who cannot read, think, or solve problems. Even among white people, there are some who are just not as good at certain tasks as other whites. We need to find what we are good at and do what we can to make a living that way, rather than sue somebody when we are passed over for a job opportunity that we are not suited for. For example, I know that I'm not a very good driver, so it would be foolish of me to try and become a truck driver and then throw a huge fit when I didn't get the job. I do have skills in other areas, such as listening, reading, and writing, so I would be better suited in occupations that emphasize these skills. Responsible white people know their abilities and limitations, and they improve what they can and work with what they have, while these persecuted minorities refuse to believe that there are some places where they just don't fit. While non-whites may be our intellectual inferiors, their strategy is actually a smart one because it has worked for them for so long. Employers and college admissions departments are so afraid of appearing racist that they will bend the rules and admission requirements for non-whites. It's easier to fill your classroom full of stupid animals than it is to deal with a lawsuit. It should come as no surprise that the New York City Fire Department would be yet another diversity-loving organization. I feel for every white family who calls for help, only to be greeted by a slobbering ape who can't even read. If we as a race are ever again to live in freedom, if we as a race are ever again to live as proud Aryans, true to our culture and warrior heritage, then we must remember with hatred the deeds of our Zionist enemies, the savage, brutal, dishonorable deeds of the past 60 years which destroyed the greatest flowering of Aryan culture the world has ever known, and which left millions of our race dead in a war for Zionist control. If we as a race are to have any future chance of glory and greatness, we must remember with hatred the slavery our people now endures at the hands of our Zionist enemies. We must remember with a raw and passionate hatred how these enemies of ours have tamed and domesticated our people, and how they have controlled them and do control them through the tyranny of Jewish ideas. We must remember these things with a raw and passionate hatred because our people must be avenged. Such passionate and hate-filled revenge is the only thing that can inspire us with a holy mission to free our people and win back the freedom we have lost. So it is that we must keep alive the stories of Zionist torture and Zionist atrocities against our people, and in particular against the German people and the loyal followers of the greatest son our Aryan race has ever produced, Adolf Hitler. Millions upon millions of fine Aryans butchered, hundreds of thousands of fine Aryan women raped, tens of thousands of valiant combat veterans tortured by cowardly Zionists, thousands and thousands unjustly imprisoned, and hundreds upon hundreds executed for imaginary war crimes. So it is that we must keep alive the truth about how the Zionists conditioned our people with the ignoble, disgusting, and brazen lie of the Holocaust, and how they have introduced tyrannical laws to imprison our people for hate crimes, and for living and acting like a true, noble, fierce, proud Aryan should. So it is that we must keep alive the truth about how these ignoble Zionists lauded it over our governments and encouraged the migration into our countries of millions upon millions of non-Aryans to destroy our nations, our culture, and take away what little freedom we possessed. If we are ever to regain the freedom we have lost, if we are ever to regain the warrior spirit we have lost, the manhood we have lost, then we must put aside our silly and pathetic squabbles among ourselves and forget our own petty egos. Instead, we must become possessed by this raw and passionate hatred for our real enemies. This hatred of our enemies and this desire for revenge must come before anything else, until we have won back our freedom and can live again among our own kind according to our Aryan customs. Anything less than this passionate desire for revenge is cowardly and unmanly and plays right into the hands of the Zionists. Let these ignoble enemies of ours scheme, cheat, lie, and act as they have always acted, in a cowardly way, getting others to do their dirty work or acting like the cowardly bullies they are. Let them moan and cry about how we are hate-mongers and bigots or whatever. For yes, we are hate-mongers, and proud of it. We hate them and all that they stand for. We shall never cease from hating them and must not cease from hating them until we have finally defeated them. We who are true warriors, true Aryans, true men are not afraid to hate, and we must never be afraid to hate. This is the foremost message we must take out among our people, pure, raw hatred of everything our enemies have done and everything they stand for. We must teach our children to hate our enemies, and we must tell our friends about what the Zionists have done and are doing to our people until these friends hate them with a passion to match our own hatred. We must pass on to others of our race this desire of ours for revenge and this passionate desire of ours for the freedom we have lost. It may take decades for our revenge to come about. It may even take a century or more. But it will and must come about if we are true to our manhood and our warrior Aryan nature. We must forget about legality. We must forget about trying to play the Zionists at their own game of manipulation, cheating, and compromise. We need and must have pure revenge, unsullied by anything else. We must have a pure lust for a war with them, a real bloody reckoning when we can get our hands upon them and give them what they deserve. Our future freedom can only be obtained through a heartfelt passion, and we must stir our people up through a passionate hatred, a hatred at what has been done to us over the past 60 years. We must once again get our blood up and not cease from our mission of revenge until we have defeated our enemies. It is this blood-boiling passion which our enemies really fear, for they know that they will only be defeated when our race has been stirred up into a frenzy of passion. This is why they have gone to so much trouble to try and outlaw hatred and tame and domesticate us. This is why they forever try to keep our people entertained and well-fed and contented, and why they try so hard to re-educate our people and make them into docile pacifists who love everybody, and especially the new foreign arrivals next door. Our enemies fear our warrior blood being roused once again, and this is what we must rouse with our cry for freedom and our cry for retribution for our people killed, maimed, tortured, imprisoned, and brainwashed. The blood of the past 60 years is upon the hands of the Zionists as it will be upon them until we have obtained our satisfaction.
Yesterday, I had a comrade over, and we spent most of the afternoon talking about what I predict might happen in the next few months regarding the Middle East and the Jewish attack on Iran, the effects it will have on this country, so forth and so on. I think this guy was a little bit surprised to see that I've, to some degree at least, joined the army of the prophets of doom that the right wing and the white nationalist movement has seen so much of down through the years. I'm a bit surprised by that myself. Look, I have been hearing doomsayers of every kind since I first got involved with the movement many, many moons ago. Matter of fact, I remember when Jimmy Carter was elected in 1976. There were people who were saying, oh, that's it. This is it. America's done. America won't last past 1978 without asshole Carter in there. And, of course, that didn't come about. In many respects, our right-wing and racial doomsayers are kind of like these doomsday cultist preacher types who tell their followers that the world is going to end at 12 minutes past midnight on September the 30th, and therefore they need to sell all their property and all their worldly goods, give all the money to him, of course, and they're all going to gather up on some kind of mesa in New Mexico or mountaintop in Switzerland or something like that, and they're going to pray and wait for the end of the world to come. They're going to wait for the Archangel Michael to come down and split the sky open with his mighty sword and wait for Jesus to descend and put his little toe on the Mount of Olives so the chasm will open up and the 144,000 Jews will suddenly be saved because they recognize Jesus as Savior and they'll run into the chasm and be saved from the Antichrist and blah, 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 blah. And by the way, that's a real theology as well. A guy named Hal Lindsey came up with that. If you're interested in it, you can read a book called The Late Great Planet Earth. My first wife was into that crap. Anyway, I'm a bit surprised myself to kind of find myself in that company because I've been hearing for decades now various people in the movement and in the right wing come up with this idea, oh, the balloon is going to go up and we can't do anything until the balloon goes up. But Harold, we'll be ready when the balloon goes up. Oh, we'll just do all this mighty brave stuff and we'll all turn into Mad Max road warriors with purple mohawks and so forth and so on. Anyway, so let me go ahead and let me just go over once again now what I think may be coming down the pike. This is not me being a prophet of doom. This is me drawing on a lifetime of reading, studying, observing, and living in the world as it exists. Learning about history, learning about human behavior, learning about human nature. And one of the big lessons that history teaches is that ruling classes, power elites, whatever you want to call them, down through the centuries have always suffered from the same serious flaw. They have overestimated their ability to control events. I am very much worried that that might be what's happening here. Now, I'm not making this up, as I'm sure all of you know. The mainstream media is discussing this at least on and off quite extensively. I noticed it's been more off than on recently. I think somebody up top has sent down the word to cool it. But if you know where to look, certain websites, you can still find some actual discussion of the potential Israeli attack on Iran. The general received wisdom is that the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is going to launch his fighter bombers or his rockets or whatever he's got at the Iranian nuclear facilities sometime in either late September or more likely in October. This is going to be the mother of all October surprises. Obama will be in the middle of a re-election campaign, which looks to be a little bit harder fought than possibly the Democrats expected, because the Republicans have finally woken up to the fact that this may be the last chance they ever have to see the inside of the White House. And so Obama will be compelled either to simply put off a decision on what Israel has done. His hands will certainly be tied in that he can't effectively stop them. Or, more likely, he will be forced by Mitt Romney and his neocon friends to bend over backwards and once more apply the presidential lips to Israel's buttocks. Now, what kind of scares me is that no one in this country really seems to get what is going to happen when Israel makes its strike against the Persian nuclear facilities. They just don't understand what's involved, largely because we've played through this scenario twice in the past 10 years, once in Afghanistan, once in Iraq. We're also now doing it in a minor way in Syria, Yemen, and Libya. So the American people have gotten hardened to American troops running around in the sand in the Middle East. It used to be, before 9/11, that very idea of an actual American military intervention in the Middle East was unthinkable. No more. Now, having American troops in the Middle East has become just something that everybody accepts, and since there is an all-volunteer army, and to my amazement, they haven't brought back the draft yet, no one really cares. They figure, well, those soldiers are just Mexicans and niggers and poor white trailer trash, and you know, that's what they're paid to do. You know, they get good pay, they get medical benefits, sort of, therefore they shouldn't complain when we have them spend 2 years and 10 months of their three-year enlistment over there in the sand, you know, getting their arms and legs blown off. We've been through all this before. We don't fully understand what's going to happen this time. We think it's going to be another Iraq or another Afghanistan. Most people probably figure, well, gas might go up another dollar a gallon, maybe $2 a gallon. More soldiers will be deployed forever, and it'll be hard on the military families, and we can have a few more rallies to support our troops, and blah, 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 blah. No one really understands in their own mind what is going to happen when the Western world loses one-third of its imported raw petroleum. That is the generally accepted figure as to how much of the world's oil imports sail through the Straits of Hormuz off the coast of Iran. All those tankers coming down from the Red Sea, from Iraq, some from Saudi. I'm not quite sure exactly how it works, but that's the figure. For some reason, we seem to have acquired the idea that the Persians are just going to sit there and twiddle their thumbs and do nothing while Jews drop bombs on them. I'm not sure where we would get that idea, but let's face it, we're stupid people. What's going to occur when that happens is that the Iranians are going to close off the Straits of Hormuz, thus, as I said, choking off one-third of the Western world's oil imports. Secondly, they are going to have their surrogates, Hezbollah in northern Lebanon and Hamas in Gaza, launch the tens of thousands of high-tech, high-explosive, long-range missiles and rockets that the Iranians have been loading them up with since about 2007. These are not like the so-called Qassam rockets that the Palestinians in Gaza have been popping off. These are not just pieces of corrugated iron or steel piping with a little black powder inside. These are actual high-tech Soviet pattern missiles that can reach all of Israel. So that's the second thing that's going to happen when Israel launches its aerial attack. All of Israel, from the north to the south, is going to come under aerial bombardment. As someone put it during the Second Lebanon War, Israel no longer has a monopoly in the Middle East of death from above. What's going to have to happen is two things. Number one, the Western world, probably through NATO, which basically means Americans will be doing 90% of the heavy lifting, will have to land a physical invasion force in certain parts of Iran to reopen the Straits of Hormuz and try and get those tankers through. The second thing that's going to have to happen is that Israel is going to have to receive massive military aid, if nothing else in the form of various missile defense systems, but most likely in the forms of troops, in order to stop the rocket shelling from northern Lebanon and Gaza. This will almost certainly involve physical invasions of northern Lebanon and southern Gaza. Those parts of the world will have to be once more reconquered and added on to greater Israel. So it's going to be a big bloody mess. I very strongly suspect that Israel now will not be able to do this without physical American help in the form of ground troops. Never mind the loss of life. Don't even worry right now about the cost of the oil imports having to be made up. The sheer expense the bottomless monetary pit of America having to go into another war in the Middle East will probably destroy what is left of the economy in this country. We just can't afford it. Our military is in bad shape. They've been deployed and deployed and deployed and deployed for the past 10 years. Most of them are battle-weary. This is why our soldiers are committing suicide, because they haven't seen home for 3 years. This is why you've got things like female soldiers being raped all the time, because female soldiers are being put into positions where they shouldn't be, because there's not enough actual ground troops. Do you know in the American military, it takes 70 support troops behind the lines to keep one combat soldier in the field? And it's just going to be an unholy mess, and that's just the military end of it. Now, it is possible, and I will admit this, that this might not happen. It's possible that Benjamin Netanyahu is bluffing with all these threats to attack Iran, because what he's trying to do is he's trying to get the rest of the world to gang up on Iran like they did on Germany back in 1939. Once again, the Jews want the Goyim to do all the fighting and the dying for the Jews, just like they did 80 years ago. If Netanyahu is bluffing, this still isn't going to have any long-term effect on the problem, because the reason Netanyahu is bluffing and huffing and puffing and beating his chest and acting like a crazed gunman who's taken hostages in a bodega and he's screaming, "I'll do it! I'll do it! I'll kill him! I'll kill him! Give me what I want or I'll kill him! I swear I'll kill him! I'll do it! I'll do it!" The reason he's acting like that is so that the rest of the world will do it for him. So the end effect on the Western world, as far as the closure of the straits and the loss of the oil imports and the retaliation against Israel, would be the same damn thing. So even if Netanyahu is bluffing, we're still not out of the woods. Now, there's something else you need to understand, and that is that the general consensus of military opinion, both in the United States, in the Pentagon, in the NATO headquarters, and in Israel itself, is that an airstrike against Persia's nuclear program won't work. The Persian nuclear labs and facilities are scattered all across a huge country the size of the state of California. They are buried deep underground with state-of-the-art protection and fortification, courtesy of the Russians and the Chinese and the Indians. Now, any air attack, and that includes an attack by the United States, would at best delay the Persian uranium enrichment program by maybe 6 months. They've got most of their good stuff buried under this big, huge mountain now, Forbnow or something, I can't pronounce it, but according to estimates which have been published in various semi-reliable media sources, even the Pentagon itself says that American bunker buster bombs will not breach these defenses. Also, you got to bear in mind that if they do have to wait till October to take advantage of the American election, that's going to be still another 3-4 months that the Persians will have to get their act together, dig their fortifications deeper, and get their atomic bomb up and going. So, one way or the other, we're going to be looking at a nuclear Iran. The way things are going right now, we're going to be looking at a very pissed-off nuclear Iran. This is not a good thing. Now, my question is this. If everybody knows that an actual attack would not stop the Persian nuclear program, why are they doing it? My guess is that it's possible now that the power structure in the world has decided to deliberately create an existential crisis of civilization so that they can seize complete and total power. Well, we've already seen signs of this in this country. We've got drones flying in the skies in America right now, and Obama says, "Well, don't worry about them. They're just for surveillance. They're not armed." Like that's supposed to make a difference. How long before the police and various other law enforcement agencies start using armed drones to blow up vehicles on superhighways or freeways, that sort of stuff? Well, they were fleeing bank robbers. We just had to blow them up. Or they were terrorists. We just had to blow them up. Or they said some bad things about Obama on a website, so we just had to blow that guy up. Given the track record of drones in Iraq and Afghanistan, as far as accuracy goes, if I were most Americans, I'd be a little bit worried about having a wedding. Because for some reason, these drones are just great at blowing up wedding receptions. That's what they seem to hit in Iraq and Afghanistan most of the time. Oh, that and elementary schools. Anyway, I'm sort of wandering here, but again, I genuinely believe this is coming. Our comrade asked me yesterday what I thought was the likelihood that Netanyahu would actually attack. I gave him 70-30, because these Jews, I think, realize that they have painted themselves into a corner. After 65 years, they still can't get that shitty little country on the eastern seaboard of the Mediterranean stabilized. The Palestinians are still resisting. I believe that Israel's plan is to provoke some kind of earth-shaking crisis, full-blown war, that will give them an excuse to finally do what they've been wanting to do since 1948. Round up all the Palestinians and deport them all. Put them in the cattle cars, put them in the trucks, take them down to Egypt or down to the Sinai Desert or across the Jordan River and just dump them. I think that's the game plan. Netanyahu has finally decided to secure greater Israel at the expense of the rest of the world. Of course, it's vile, it's evil, it's cynical, it's totally narcissistic, totally uncaring, and generally wicked. It is Jewish, but then that's who they are. I genuinely believe, not as a prophet of doom, but simply as a student of history, that there is a chance that this may happen. I'll be talking more in future podcasts as the situation clarifies about the probable results of this event when it does happen. But again, guys, just let me emphasize, I'm not trying to be a prophet of doom here. I'm not saying that the world is going to end. I am saying that the world is going to be very, very different, and we all need to be ready for it. That last song put me in kind of a outlaw mood, so this is an old number from the Kingston Trio.
Well, early one evening, I was rolling around. I was feeling kind of mean. I shot the deputy down. Strolled along home and I went to bed. Well, I laid my pistol up under my head.
He strolled along home.
I took my time.
And he went to bed.
Thought I'd sleep some.
Laid his pistol.
Big 22.
Up under his head.
I keep it handy. Well, early in the morning, about the break of day, I figured it was time to make a getaway. Stepping right along, but I was stepping too slow. Got surrounded by a sheriff down in Mexico.
He was stepping right along.
I wore a hot foot in it,
but he was stepping too slow.
It was a sultry day.
Got surrounded by a sheriff.
Boxed
in Mexico.
I didn't even have a chance to see the country. When I was arrested, didn't have a dime. The sheriff says, son, you're riding free this time. Where you're going, you won't need a cent. Cause the great state of Texas gonna pay your rent.
Cause where you're going,
I think he means jail.
You won't need a cent.
Well, he knows I'm broke.
Cause the great state of Texas,
yippee,
gonna pay your rent.
I'm mighty grateful, fellas. Well, I didn't have a key and I didn't have a file. Naturally, I stayed around until my trial. Judge was an old man, 93, and I didn't like the way the jury looked at me.
Well, the judge was an old man,
too old,
93,
entirely too old. I didn't like the way the jury looked at me. I think they were suspicious.
The judge and the jury, they did agree. They all said murder in the first degree. The judge said, say,
I don't know whether to hang you or not, but this here killing of deputy sheriff, they just naturally got to stop.
You got a point there, judge. It was a most unsatisfactory trial. They gave me 99 years on the hard rock pile. 99 on the hard rock ground. All I ever did was shoot a deputy down.
99.
It could have been life
on the hard rock pile.
They might have hung me.
And all he ever did was shoot a deputy down.
I've been trying to put myself inside you guys' heads and figure out exactly what it is that prevents you from getting out of the burning building you're living in. Now, that's what you're doing by continuing to sit there in your grubby furnished apartment in Jacksonville, or your McMansion in the Chicago suburb, or your trailer home in Texas, or your mother's basement in Montgomery, Alabama, wherever. You're sitting there playing with your computer while the world around you slowly burns away. And at some point, the fire is going to eat through the foundations and the floorboards, and your computer is going to fall through the floor into the flames, along with your desk and your chair with you in it. Now, why the hell don't you get out of the burning building? It's not because most of you don't know it's on fire. Hell, that's mostly all you talk about on the internet. Some of you can even smell your own flesh starting to char and burn, and yet still you just sit there. Why? Most of you even know, or claim to understand, that the Northwest is the only way out. So why are you still sitting there in front of that computer in that burning building instead of out on the interstate heading northwest? I know, figuring out just what the devil is wrong with the white man in America and why we continue to just die quietly has always been one of the right wing's major pastimes. But since we're most likely running out of time for real now, I'm making an emergency effort to try and get inside you guys' heads and figure out just what the fuck is making you tick. Why are you acting like this in defiance of all common sense? So that I can make one final attempt to reach you before Netanyahu attacks Iran, gas hits $17 a gallon, and what's left of America falls apart. I have a few ideas. Let's run this one up the flagpole and see if anybody salutes. I think we're suffering from something that can be a good thing in its proper place, but which can also be incredibly dangerous if it's not thought through and if it's not based on reality. I'm talking about optimism. Being an optimist when the world around you is burning and the society you live in is drowning in its own shit and vomit is just plain stupid, but what can I tell you? That's us. Maybe that's why the Irish seem to have survived the last 50 years better than the Americans. They got all the optimism kicked out of them by British boots a long time ago. Now, most middle Americans are socially engineered from birth to exhibit certain character traits, most of them really weak and neurotic and sucky, but optimism is one of the better ones. The Jews need us to be optimistic, so that as things in this country slowly deteriorate, as they've been deteriorating for many years, and when things in this country just plain crash, as has happened since Obama was immaculated, white Americans will always console themselves with this completely baseless idea that somehow, someday, things will get better. This is part and parcel of something else that most of us drank in with our mother's milk, courtesy of the Jew and liberal social engineering process. And that is the idea of American exceptionalism, as the neocons call it. American exceptionalism is this absurd notion that America is somehow better and more virtuous than the other nations of the earth, that after his chosen people, the Jews, God likes us best, and that we are somehow thereby immune from the cosmic forces of human nature, human fallibility, and human history. Really, really bad things happen to other countries, never here, and somehow, someday, no matter how much this stupid nigger in the White House and his little Jewish friends in the banks and the Federal Reserve screw the pooch, America will just bounce back, and there will be two cars and an SUV in every garage again, there'll be 700 channels on the satellite dish, high-paying cubicle jobs for anyone who wants them, and we'll all be driving 100 miles to hit Six Flags again every weekend. No. It's not gonna happen. Listen to me, you morons. No, it's not going to get better. Not ever. 9% official unemployment, 20% real unemployment, and 35% white male over 40 unemployment is now the new normal. Obama and the Democrats say so. The days when you can feed yourself by picking up a phone and ordering Domino's or Chinese takeout are gone. After the Jews bomb Iran and close those straits, you and your family will take what you can get from the food bank and be damn glad of it. With $17 per gallon gas, your job is gone, either because you can't afford to drive to work or because whatever you do is dependent on affordable energy, and the company folds because there's no more raw materials and no more business because nobody can buy whatever it is anymore. No more suburban paradise. No more Monday night football. No more slacking. No more skating. No more passes on the bad parts of life. From now on, every bill has come due and white boys are stuck with the check. Eventually, no more roof over your head except in government housing surrounded by black and brown garbage, spied on by closed circuit TV and drones in the sky. America's over, dumbass. Now begins the long decline into racial and national death. You may end up having some kids, but if your bitch of an ex-wife doesn't take them from you, you will go mad trying to feed them and care for them and protect them in the world that's coming. In the politically correct tyranny of one-party Democrat rule, which is coming as soon as the illegals are amnestied by a re-elected Obama and given the vote, society and the law will not allow you to protect your children from most of what threatens them. You can't stop your kids from going on drugs. You can't stop your kids from turning into faggots. You can't stop your kids from being placed on drugs like Ritalin in the schools. You can't stop your kids from being taught filth and degeneracy and lies in the schools, so forth and so on. You can't stop your kids from being abducted and strangled and have their throats cut and dumped in a ditch by perverts. You can't stop your kids from being dragged in the military and sent to some Middle Eastern country and slaughtered. You can't stop your daughters, if any, from having state-ordered abortions without your permission. Now, last week I asked you a question. I'm going to ask it again to make sure it sinks into your skulls full of mush. Think about where you're living right now. How far do you drive to work? What does your job do, and how is it dependent on fossil fuel energy, as almost all American economic activity is in some way? How physically close are the niggers and the Mexicans to you? 10 miles down the road? 5 miles? 20 city blocks? 10? Just down the street? Next door? How close? What's going to happen? No, I mean for real. When the police and the fire department and the paramedics don't get paid and they've got no gas for their cars and trucks and ambulances and no one will come when you call 911. What are you going to do? No, I mean really. When you've got a mob of 50 or 100 niggers or beaners outside your house trying to smash in. Not so much to kill you and rape the women, although that as well, but mostly just to take any food and AA batteries you've got. And don't give me all this crap about how big and bad and tough you are, and you got all these guns, which you keep in the closet, and when the balloon goes up, you're going to do this, and you're going to do that, and you're going to kill 7 at one blow like the brave little Taylor. You ain't going to do doodly squat. If you had the balls to do anything, we wouldn't be in this mess, and we wouldn't have a monkey jumping up and down going ook and eek in the White House today. Listen to me, you bird brain. Get out. Turn off that computer. Get that mouse out of your hand. Pack that U-Haul and get your ass up here to the Northwest while the weather's still good and there is still some chance that you can get housing and get settled into a reasonably white area where the real battle is going to take place with some chance of our grabbing back some of our own land to live on. Yeah, I know, it does no good, but I have to keep on trying. Anyway, here's another outlaw song. This is The Byrds.
Well, gather around me, children, a story I will tell about Pretty Buck Moore, the outlaw. The homer knew him well. It was in the town of Shawnee on a Saturday afternoon. His wife beside him in a wagon, as into town he rode. And along come a deputy sheriff in a manner rather rude, using vulgar words of language his wife she overheard. And Pretty Boy grabbed the log chain, the deputy grabbed a gun, and in the fight that followed, he laid that deputy down. When he ran through the trees and bushes, he lived a life of shame. Every crime in Oklahoma was added to his name. Bushes on the Canadian River shore, and many a starving farmer opened up his door. Was in Oklahoma City, it was on a Christmas day, a whole carload of groceries with a letter that could say, "You say that I'm an outlaw, you say that I'm a thief. Well, here's a Christmas dinner for families on relief." As through this life you travel, you'll meet some funny men. Some will rob you with a six gun and some with a fountain pen. As through this life you ramble, as through this life you roam, you'll never see an outlaw take a family from your home.
When you finally decide to listen to me, by which I mean do what I say, and when we finally get the heavy lifting done and chase all the human detritus out of the Northwest and get our constitutional convention going, this is the kind of proclamation we will issue as the law of the land. It is taken from my novel, Freedom's Sons, Book 1, Chapter 4. The following document, subsequently known as the Basic Act of Establishment and General Repeal, was published in all major newspapers of the Northwest Republic and delivered in the form of a nationwide televised address by the acting state president on March the 7th. Although predating the actual ratification of the Northwest Constitution by some months, the Basic Act laid down the ground rules of the new state and is considered by historians as the formal beginning of the new republic and the end of the cleanup, by formally reinstituting the rule of law. The Constitutional Convention and Government of the Northwest American Republic assembled at Olympia in anticipation of the adoption of the Constitution of the Republic by the aforesaid convention do hereby declare and proclaim for the purpose of interim governance the following acts of repeal, and do also decree the following affirmative statutes and acts, to wit. Number 1. The Constitutional Convention now sitting at Olympia and the government instituted by the convention are henceforth the sole governing authority of the Northwest American Republic. Martial law is hereby rescinded in all remaining counties of the republic wherein it is still in effect, and the entire republic is henceforth under civil authority. Number 2. All federal, state, municipal, county, and other law enforcement agencies that existed under the United States are hereby abolished. All law enforcement, plant, property, premises, and personnel are herewith consolidated into the Northwest Civil Guard. Number 3. Elections for all offices under the new Constitution to be promulgated and ratified by the Convention will take place no more than 30 days after ratification, the precise date to be determined by the Electoral Committee. Number 4. Graduated franchise. For the purpose of the Republic's initial national elections only, any resident of the NAR over age 18 may be granted third-class citizenship and one vote thereby, provided they swear an oath of loyalty to the Republic before an election commissioner and bring the notarized instrument of said oath to the polls on Election Day. Residents requesting third-class citizenship must also produce a certificate from the Civil Guard affirming that the individual in question did not commit any acts or crimes in the service of the United States government or its multifarious agencies during the War of Independence that were of an especially heinous, cruel, or violent nature, and that furthermore, according to all information available, the said petitioning individual did not at any time during the war act in the capacity of an informer or collaborator with the United States forces. Second-class citizenship, carrying two votes for electoral purposes, is hereby granted to all serving members of the Northwest Defense Force, as well as to all women who can prove that they are the mother of three or more children living in the home or resident elsewhere in the Republic. First-class citizenship carrying three votes for electoral purposes is hereby granted to all personnel over the age of 14 years who served in the Northwest Volunteer Army or who served the party in any capacity either during or prior to the War of Independence. First-class citizenship is also hereby granted to all members of the Northwest Defense Force who fought in the Battle of Portland from November the 1st through November the 4th, or who have been decorated for valor in combat during the consolidation, or who served in the unit designated as Force 101. Number 5. All laws and ordinances that previously existed under the United States of America and its state and local governments, which in any way prohibit, restrict, control, or limit the keeping or bearing of arms, the open carrying of arms, and the possession and transportation of firearms, ammunition, powder supplies, cartridge casings, or any other material necessary to the exercise of the First Amendment of the Northwest Constitution, are hereby repealed and declared to be null, void, and of no effect. Number 6. All vouchers, receipts, and IOUs issued by officers and other personnel of the Northwest Volunteer Army and the Northwest Defense Force for personal property, cash, food, supplies, vehicles, fuel, weapons, and ammunition, or other material during the War of Independence and the Consolidation must be presented for payment to any office of the Ministry of Finance or the Northwest Defense Force within a period of 10 years dating from this proclamation, Such vouchers or receipts must be presented by the original persons to whom they were issued, or by their legal heirs. Where possible, such documents shall be authenticated by the original issuing NVA or NDF officer if they can be located before payment. If the original issuing officer is dead or cannot be located, the Ministry and the NDF shall make reasonable assumption of good faith and shall reimburse such creditors. Number 7. All debts owed to American financial institutions, specifically to include home mortgages and liens on any commercial or industrial property, credit card debt, automobile debt, student loans, and all other forms of corporate indebtedness or indebtedness to Jews or Jewish financial institutions that existed prior to the signing of the treaty at Longview, are hereby declared null and void. Existing home ownership in the Republic shall be determined on grounds of present occupancy. The Bureau of Race and Resettlement shall expedite the transfer of title deeds free and clear to homeowners. Number 8. All real estate, money, valuables, fixtures, vehicles, and other property abandoned by white persons who have fled the Republic will be deeded to the National Abandoned Property Trust established by the Convention on February the 20th, and shall be placed in a state of escrow for a period of 1 year from the date of this proclamation. During that time, any person seeking the restoration of any real or personal property thus sequestered, or seeking compensation for any property which, for any reason, cannot or will not be returned, may make application at any office of the trust or at any civil guard station, provided that such application shall be made in person by the property owner and that said property owner provide proof of their permanent return to the Northwest Republic. Number 9. At the conclusion of the 1 year period described in the previous paragraph, any and all abandoned property that remains unclaimed may be sold or distributed to such governmental or private agencies as the officers of the trust and the government of the NAR shall determine. Number 10. All real estate, money, valuables, fixtures, vehicles, and other abandoned property reasonably determined to have been owned by Jews, by non-whites, by sexual deviants, by the United States government, or by any American state or local government, by any corporate entity hostile to the Republic, or by any individual determined to have been irredeemably hostile to the Republic during the War of Independence, is herewith declared to be the property of the state and shall be distributed among the appropriate government departments and agencies. The Ministry of Defense shall have first refusal on all American military property and installations. The Ministry of Race and Resettlement shall have first refusal on all housing for potential use for new immigrants. The Ministry of Finance shall receive all identifiable enemy cash, stocks and bonds, coins and precious metals, jewelry, and other movable personal property of value that can be liquidated for the Treasury. Number 11. The retail sale of alcoholic beverages and intoxicating liquors is hereby declared to be a state revenue monopoly and shall be administered through the Alcoholic Beverage Control Board, which shall be a statutory body to be run at a profit for the benefit of the Treasury. Private sale of alcoholic beverages by individuals and businesses shall be legal, but subject to taxation to be determined at a later date. Number 12. The retail sale of tobacco products is hereby declared to be a state revenue monopoly and shall be administered through the Tobacco Control Board, which shall be a statutory body to be run at a profit for the benefit of the Treasury. Private cultivation of tobacco and sale of tobacco products shall be legal, but subject to taxation to be determined at a later date. Number 13. All laws and ordinances of the United States and its several states and local authorities prohibiting the use, possession, cultivation, and transportation of marijuana and/or cannabis products are hereby repealed and rendered null and void. The Ministry of Finance and the future Parliament may, at their discretion, impose excise taxes on the cultivation of cannabis hemp and the manufacture and sale of marijuana and cannabis-related products. Number 14. The use, possession, sale, importation, and transportation of hard narcotics such as powdered cocaine, crack or crystal cocaine, methamphetamine, ecstasy, heroin, PCP, and lysergic acid shall not be illegal per se, but until such time as these substances pose no further risk to the fabric of society, shall be treated by the Civil Guard and the Ministry of Justice as an antisocial activity and dealt with as the appropriate authorities see fit. The use of capital punishment is authorized in especially egregious cases. Number 15. Homosexuality is henceforth legally defined as a mental illness, Those suffering from this condition will be suitably confined in secure mental facilities for treatment. The Civil Guard and Ministry of Justice may reserve the right to prosecute the commission of actual homosexual acts through the criminal code. Number 16. The practice of infanticide by abortion is prohibited except in cases where two physicians certify to the Ministry of Public Health and the Ministry of Justice that the prospective carrying of a fetus to full term constitutes a clear and present danger to the life of the mother, or else that the fetus will be born irremediably mentally retarded, brain damaged, or dead. Subsequent confirmation is to be obtained prior to any abortive procedure by a third physician acting under the direction of the Ministry of Public Health. Individual cases of infanticide will be treated by the state and by law enforcement as acts of premeditated murder. Number 17. National Service. The first national service intake of young people aged 18 to 20 who have completed high school will begin on June the 21st. All citizens and residents of the Republic aged from 15 to 20 must immediately register for national service. National service shall consist of 1 year in the National Labor Service and 2 years in the Northwest Defense Force for males, and 2 years in the National Labor Service for females. Female citizens and residents of the Republic may be exempted from up to 1 year of national service on grounds of impending or recent maternity. For the first 3 years from the date of this proclamation, young men may, upon graduation from high school, opt to go directly into the Northwest Defense Force for a period of 2 years. All persons having completed national service will subsequently be eligible to attend any college, university, or technical school in the Republic free of charge for tuition and housing. Number 18. All laws and ordinances that existed under the United States and its several states and local authorities dealing with taxation, regulation, and or control of private business and enterprise are hereby repealed and rendered null and void and of no effect. Number 19. All laws and ordinances that existed under the United States and its several states and local authorities dealing with the taxation of income and of homesteads housing individuals and families are hereby repealed and rendered null and void and of no effect. Number 20. The conversion of the Northwest American Republic to its own currency, the Northwest Credit, shall begin on the first day of July of this year for a transitional period of 6 months until the 31st day of December, after which date no monies other than the Northwest Credit shall be accepted as legal tender in the Republic. The previous passage from my novel is fiction. If you guys ever decide you want to do it for real, I'm in. Well, our time is up, and so that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington 98104. Or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sisha Andaban. Freedom.